I expect that probably if we went out and started asking people, we could get most people to come up with a pretty good working definition of madness. However, if we ask them to define sanity, we would discover that, in fact, that's much more difficult. In practice, often, sanity has come to mean simply the absence of mental disturbance. However, our guest for this part of Focus 580, psychoanalyst Adam Phillips, says that there's really a lot more to it than that. It's more complicated than that. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about a recently published book that he has authored. The title of the book is Going Sane, Maps of Happiness. The book is just out recently here in the United States, published by Forth. It's an imprint of HarperCollins. I think the book previously was published in Britain, where Adam Phillips makes his home. He's a psychoanalyst. He's the author of 10 previously published books. He writes regularly for the New York Times, The Observer, the London Review of Books. He's also general editor of the new Penguin Modern Classics Freud Translations and is considered to be an authority on the work of Sigmund Freud. This morning, as we talk about some of the ideas in the book, Going Sane, of course, people who are listening would be welcome to call with comments and questions. All we ask of people who call in is that people are just brief, as can be, and we ask that simply so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep the program moving. But anyone who is listening is certainly welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means no matter where you might be listening, you can use that toll-free line and we'll pay for the call. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois or in Indiana, or you might be listening over the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Phillips, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us. You in the book, you make the point that while there has been a lot written about madness, while it figures prominently in literature, both classical and popular, and certainly many scientists, psychologists, psychiatrists, analysts have written about madness, about insanity. Your line, I think, in the book is that nobody has ever written a history of sanity. Mm. And it seems curious, given the fact that we are obviously very interested in it and also rather afraid of it, that is madness, insanity, that we haven't given more attention to its polar opposite. Why is it that you think no one has ever written a history of sanity?
Well, it is very puzzling, and it was precisely this, in a way, that made me want to write the book, because it suggests, in a way, that either we have a kind of tacit belief that really there's no such thing as sanity, or there is something about ideas of sanity that are particularly difficult to articulate. Now, I don't actually know which it is, but I think it's possible that there's a sense in which people are quite wary about giving their own account of what sanity might be. And my guess is that there's some fear about this. I don't quite know what it is exactly. The fear might be to discover that actually we are really mad, that there's no alternative to madness. Or the fear might be that in talking about sanity, we might begin to generate kind of moral ideals for ourselves that are quite difficult, demanding.
Mm-hmm. You just touched on something there, and it was something that came through my mind as well. And I think that perhaps sometimes the criticism of the counseling profession is that they believe that, in fact, that everyone is mentally ill. It's simply a matter of degree. And if that is the case, then, in fact, maybe there is no such thing as sanity.
Yes. I mean, I think the thing that is probably disturbing is the idea that there are simply norms that we all have to accept and abide by. Mm. So I think what might be worrying about the counseling profession is the sense in which it offers a standard that is supposed to apply to everybody, whereas you could think that one of the values of counseling or psychotherapy or whatever is that it frees people to find out what they themselves think about things.
And that gets at another issue that I think that you deal with, and it's an interesting one, and perhaps it's something that the people who are interested in the history of psychology and psychotherapy would know about, but others not, and that is the extent to which there has been something of a debate, particularly, I think this was true in the 1960s, about mental illness and wellness, and somewhere along the lines that some people are making this argument that being sane, and we'll put that in quotes, means an individual giving up something of their true selves by being the person perhaps that other people or that society wants us to be. So in that sense, there is some sort of, people see some sort of connection between mental disturbance and the people that we really are, and that somehow being sane makes us less than the people that we really are. At least there are some people who make an argument like that.
Yes, I mean, I think that for some people, sanity is associated with kind of conformity, mm-hmm. with, in a sense, having to give up everything that is most idiosyncratic or singular or original or irrational about yourself. I think the problem with this view is that, in some ways, idealizing madness underestimates just how miserable, just how terrible the suffering is of madness, and also how boring it is. How repetitive it is for the people who are trapped in it. I mean, one of the things that I was most struck by in thinking of the book was that sanity was a subject that most people were not at all interested in. But the people who were really interested in it were people who'd had experience themselves of madness, or indeed had grown up with mad relatives or parents or whatever. In other words, for them, sanity was an urgent preoccupation, the possibility that there were alternatives to this profound misery.
Pardon me, were you going to...
No, go on.
Yeah, I was just... one other thing, and I have a caller here, and I will try to get them in fairly soon, but I guess one of the things that also intrigues me is this idea that, on the one hand, that madness, insanity, mental illness is something that frightens us. It's a highly stigmatizing condition. It is for that reason that it's difficult sometimes for people who are having difficulty. It's difficult for them to go out and get help because they're perhaps they don't want to admit they're having a problem. Mm-hmm. They don't want other people to know. And given the fact that we're afraid of madness, it's almost as if we're afraid that it's contagious, that we don't want to get near somebody else. Given all of that, though, it's interesting that there is so much discussion of it. It does figure so much in popular culture and in popular literature that it's odd that we would be so willing to talk about something that we're also very afraid of.
Yes, I think it is. But I think in a way, it's as though it's sort of flagged up, but not that much talked about in detail. Because I think you're right. I think there's a lot of shame and a lot of anxiety about suffering from anything we experience that sets us apart from other people. And that involves suffering and involves not really understanding who we are or what's going on inside us. But I think that a lot of the talk, it's a bit like the talk of sexuality, which is there's a lot of talk about it because there's so much anxiety about it. And I think what's striking about it, in a sense, in the talk about sexuality, is that very little is said that seems very resonant or meaningful, even though there are lots of words. And I think the same is true of forms of human unhappiness and suffering, which is that they're talked about, but actually people are very worried about going into detail, about really following through what they feel about what they're feeling.
And why is that, you suppose?
I think there are lots of reasons. I think that, in a way, we live in... I don't want to speak for you, because I don't know what the culture is like here, but I think we live in very intolerant, conformist cultures. And I think people are very frightened of following up their own thoughts, the strange thoughts that cross their minds, or the feelings that don't make sense to them. I think there's a very strong wish to be part of a consensus, and a great deal of fear about being odd or strange or peculiar or weird to other people and to oneself. And so I think there's almost a pressure to be narrow-minded. It's a bit like inside us there's a sort of democracy of competing voices, and we're always trying to narrow it down into a kind of fascist state in which there'll be a coherent story and we'll know what's going on.
Yeah, I think, and I'm not sure that in that respect that the United States is all that much different than Britain is. Even though we like to give lip service to the idea of individualism, I'm not sure that in point of fact that we're as tolerant of people who stand apart as you would think, given the fact that it's so much a part of our national kind of mythology.
You know? Well, I suppose one way of repressing individualism is to claim that you're committed to it.
Well, let's talk with the caller that we have here on our line number one, someone listening here in Urbana, where we are. Hello.
Good morning. At the risk of jumping ahead to a later part of the discussion, when you discussed the question about difficulty of describing sanity concisely, it occurred to me that one of the elements of that, at least, is that it changes. A sane 4-year-old, 14-year-old, and 24-year-old could be described differently. And if the descriptions were switched to another age, they would be crazy, non-functional, or at least very, very odd.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right. And indeed, I talk in the book about the way in which at transitional stages in our lives, it's as though we are allowed to be temporarily mad. So as, say, young children or as adolescents or indeed in midlife crises, it's as though we have a holiday from sanity. That at these developmental stages, it's legitimate for us to behave a bit strangely. But then the assumption is that we will return to normal. Now, what's striking about these transitional stages in people's lives is that these are often stages when they feel very intensely alive. And it's almost as though they can't bear the intensity of their aliveness, of the range of their feelings. So very quickly, there's a flight into something like sanity. But of course, as you say, these are very different states of mind at different stages in the life cycle.
I bring this up because it's still very sharp in my memory. The first time I heard an experiment described, an apparently simple one in which researchers asked matched pairs of parents and children at certain ages, what was the most impressive and important event that occurred to you? So the kids would look back on their childhood, and the parents would be asked what happened at those particular ages. And it always seemed like the parents and the children remembered totally different things.
Yeah.
The parents were afraid this and that happened, and I thought it would scar the child for life, and the child hardly remembers it. And the child says, somebody gave me a cutout doll, something almost trivial, but it suited their needs at that point so much, they remember the shock and impression of getting it. In any event...
But in some way, that's the most interesting thing, isn't it? That nobody can tell somebody else what's important or significant for them. And that children, like adults, find the most unexpected things very, very meaningful. And they're not obviously things that everyone agrees are important.
Well, I bring this up because it strikes me as part of the problem of defining functionality and adaptability, because at every different age and under every different circumstances, what you do and how you feel about it may shift. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, I think that that's something that you that I think you would agree with, that's perhaps part of the difficulty with coming up with this definition is that you have to have a definition that's somewhat flexible, because it may depend indeed who you are and at what stage of life you are, how it is we're going to think about this thing we call sanity.
Very much so, yes. I mean, a plausible account of sanity wouldn't be a fixed definition. It would have to accommodate the range that gentleman was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, one of the things you might value in a sane life would be the experience of things that felt very intensely meaningful to oneself that may not be very shareable with other people, and that indeed may surprise yourself. You could think, for example, it is sane to be able to surprise yourself, whereas a lot of people in the sort of cartoon definition of sanity would think the aim of life is to become predictable to oneself.
Hmm. I suppose that does provide another possible answer to this question, why it is that we don't think very much about sanity, or why no one has ever written a history of sanity, is that it's some people would say, well, in fact, sanity is not very interesting. And people who are sane are not very interesting. It again makes me think about your line in the book where you say that, like the good characters in literature, un, like the good characters literature, the sane don't have any memorable lines.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the, and again, this is another reason why I wrote the book, which is that sanity seems deeply boring as a prospect. But one of the striking things is that if you get people to define sanity, they begin by saying quite predictable, slightly banal things, that it's to do with being fair or reasonable or kind or whatever. But very quickly, they start saying really rather crazy things about sanity. That if you let yourself talk about it, you discover you've got ideas about sanity that you really didn't realize you had, and they're really quite strange. And so I suppose what I'm wondering in the book is this interesting? You know, is this redeemable? Is there anything good to say here? Because if there isn't, it does mean that we're sort of committed to madness as the most interesting account of our lives, or to mad people as in some way having the profoundest human experiences. And that seems to me to be debatable.
It seems you're making the argument that in some sense that this project of trying to define sanity, there's some connection between being able to define it and being able to experience it.
Yes, I suppose I think that in a way we live by stories, and that we get our ideas about how we want to live and who we are and who we want to be and so on from the culture we live in. So we're very dependent upon stories right from the beginning. And it seemed to be striking that there are no stories about sanity. Now, I'm talking about sanity in the book as a kind of moral ideal, as what version of a good life would there be? Because in this culture we live in, it's quite clear that a good life is a healthy life or a long life or a successful life or a life in which one becomes rich and famous. And again, I have a chapter in the book on money, as you know, where it's as though suddenly there's a universal object of desire. Everybody wants money, as though that solves the problem of wanting. Well, I think what I'm wondering about is whether, if sanity was to be the moral ideal, whether it could incorporate more of a diversity of projects.
Let's talk with another caller. Here we have someone on a cell phone, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering, where does addiction fit into this scenario? Do you think that the description of sanity kind of promotes people to try and achieve that by soothing their soul with alcohol or drugs?
Well, I think addiction is another narrowing of the mind in a way. I think that people are so troubled by the diversity and the conflict of their needs and wants that there's a sort of internal project to narrow it down. And an addiction is an extreme version of this. It's as though you know exactly what you want. It's the drug you're addicted to. So there's no, you don't have to take time both thinking about what you want, feeling what you might want, experiencing the conflicts about what you might want.
It's easy, yeah, to take a drink and it's gone.
Yes, I mean, exactly. And I think probably everybody knows a state of mind in which they feel extremely restless and bored, and they know they want something and they don't know what it is. And in that mood, people often shop or eat or do all sorts of things. That's the state of mind, I think, where people, out of the anxiety of not knowing what they want, sort of rush to decide it too quickly. And in doing that, I think they lose their real desire.
I gotcha. Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. And other questions, comments are certainly welcome. Our guest this morning is Adam Phillips. He is a psychoanalyst. He makes his home in London. He's the author of a number of books, including the book that we're talking about here this morning, which is titled Going Sane, Maps of Happiness. He is a regular contributor for publications, including the New York Times, The Observer, The London Review of Books. He's also general editor of the new Penguin Modern Classics Freud Translations. If you're interested in the book, that you can find in the bookstore, I'm sure. Also, questions are welcome here. Again, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Just to get back to the suggestion that the first caller made about looking at different people at stages of their lives and that perhaps telling us that your definition of sanity has to be somewhat flexible. By looking at this from a kind of a developmental perspective, I guess, does that help you in perhaps understanding this territory, and particularly looking at the business of how people, as they grow part of what growing is a matter of self-governance, I guess.
Yes, I mean, I'm by training a child psychotherapist, and so I've done a lot of my work has been with children, so that's a very important part of this for me. I do think that there is, inevitably, the most striking thing about people is that they change through the life cycle. And it seems as though we've got a sort of dominant picture of what should happen, which is that there is increasing self-control. That it's as though our model is something like, I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but as though there's a sort of wild animal that's potentially out of control, that needs a lot of disciplining and reining in and guidance and education and so on in order to form him or her to be a responsible citizen. Now, it seems to me the implication of this picture is a sense that actually we're very frightened of ourselves. That the feeling is that if you don't put all this input into the developing human creature, they will do all sorts of wild, forbidden things. Now, it may not be the best picture. There may be other pictures of what it is to develop. It may, for example, be true that very intensity of desire and need and so on that we feel may be the thing that makes us feel most alive. So that those people who are the most self-disciplined, the most capable of sacrificing some of their desires, can be the people who feel the most bored or can feel that their lives are futile and so on, because the very things they most want are the things they, in fact, have to distract themselves from wanting.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here in Urbana in line number one. Hello.
We're talking about development and changes in one's mentality over a lifetime. I have some experience with a more cyclic kind of change, at its worst, bipolar. And my question is, short of caving into just taking drugs, I become very interested in maintain a sleep journal and so forth and so on, and almost can predict if sometimes my thought processes and creativity is at a very high peak and I sleep very little, and then almost predictably once or twice in the year I'll kind of go like a bear into hibernation, at least mentally, and the same things that would be rote, utterly simple for me at other times in the year are massive conundrum. How does this fit into your views of sanity in the sense that I've almost come to view it that seasonally I have two versions of myself?
Yes.
The high speed and the slumber.
Well, the thing you're describing, I think, would be one version of this, which is that one would come to some self-acceptance of who one happens to be. And if you can bear the rhythm that you're describing, then it's very useful, presumably, to know that that is what is happening. So you can allow yourself to be that when you feel it.
Uh-huh.
The most disabling thing would be to feel that actually you need to do something to that, that really you shouldn't be experiencing this oscillation of mood. And then it seems to me you could create a problem for yourself.
Well, I've had the experience some years ago of having that problem for myself created by those who were apparently trying to help me. And I did find that there wasn't much upside or much downside to the cure other than the oscillation was smaller and I didn't feel like myself, period.
Yeah. Well, that in a way, that's the one of the things I'm talking about in the book, which is that anybody who's got a notion of what a cure is must have a notion of what it is to be a sane person. And the trouble is that these views can be very militant. They can be very coercive. They can be actually very much against the grain. So one would want people to be free to be able to be critical of other people's standards of mental health, because they really may not suit you.
Well, thank you. I found that, as you said, the awareness of the rhythm has helped me quite a bit. If you were playing golf in a British Open course, the same hole one day is reachable in two, and the other day you have to hit the ball four times against the wind. And I've kind of taken that view seasonally and made preparations as to, so to speak, club selection and strategy and it's helped me quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Anyway, thank you.
All right, well, thanks for the call. And again, other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess this continues to what some of the callers are saying, and my sort of reaction to some of the things that you're saying continues to put out this idea that that in fact what we're really talking about here when we're talking about sanity is not it's not the absence, the total absence of dysfunction, but it has something to do with recognizing your own particular dysfunction and learning in some sense it means learning to live with it.
Yes, but also I think wondering something about what makes you think that any given part of yourself is a dysfunction. Because obviously the implication of that is that you have inside you some blueprint of what it is to function properly or appropriately or well. And it seems to me that one of the things one finds, given one is born into a world that one didn't invent, which already has languages in it and so on, is the most difficult thing for the growing individual person is to feel that they can actually have conversations about the ways in which they function that's not merely fitting in with the available forms of function they're being offered by their doctors, teachers, and so on and so forth. That's the most difficult thing to engage in. So that, in a way, I suppose it might be part of a sane view to think that I may not, that functioning, for example, it may not be the best way of describing myself. Or I clearly function more like a tree than a car, say. In other words, you want to wonder about what your pictures are of who you are and how you do what you do.
Let's talk again with another caller, line number one. This is, again, someone in Urbana. Hello.
Champagne, but that's okay.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Back in the 80s, I had a class with a professor here on the campus at the University of Illinois. I believe it was Dr. Ed Diener, and his focus of study was happiness. And he's making, or he made at the time, some of the same arguments that you're making. Psychology typically focuses on dysfunction versus function. And we know a lot about why people are unhappy or why people are dysfunctional. We don't know, or at least that's the argument he was making, and it sounds like the argument you're making. We don't know enough about what makes people happy or functional. How do you think the world of psychology would be different if we started to focus more on mental health versus mental illness? You know, we have things like the Department of Mental Health, but we all know what they're really focusing on are people with mental illness. How would school change? How would the way we deal with people in society who are not mentally healthy change? How would therapy change? What would be some of the big changes if we focused more on this idea of function or sanity or happiness? You know, the states that we all say we desire in our mental life, but the states that it seems like we don't always achieve. And I'll also just be curious if you've heard of Ed Diener and some of the work that he did.
I haven't actually, no.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll listen offline for the rest of your answer.
All right. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I think there is a significant difference between sanity and happiness. Somebody can be sane and unhappy. I think these distinctions matter, but I do think that your point is right, which is that, in a way, the problem is having these binary opposites, as though people are mentally ill or mentally well, or bad or good, or functioning or not functioning. It may well be that what we actually need, and we get this, I think, more from reading sort of fiction, short stories, novels, than we do from science, scientific science, which is we need all the nuance. We need the range of descriptions of who we are and how we live. So the part of the problem for me of scientific psychology is that it's always trying to produce overriding categories, whereas in fact, people obviously go in and out of the categories that are available in the culture. So I think, for example, psychotherapy or psychology would be better if, when somebody came with a problem, one of the things that the conversation would involve would be a discussion about, for example, from whose point of view is this a problem, and what about it makes it a problem. And that might be the place to start, not always, but sometimes. The other thing, I think, is that there is a risk that, having grown up in a sort of Judeo-Christian culture, people are going to start from the position that there's something wrong with them, that they're radically flawed creatures. Now, of course, they might genuinely believe this. But if they don't wholeheartedly believe it, they're very likely to be involved in a conversation in which the project is to think of oneself as fundamentally ill or flawed or bad. And then the question becomes, and how can you feel better? Well, feeling better may not be quite the right emphasis. It may be, for example, better to feel realer or to feel as complex and complicated as you feel yourself to be. Now, that might make you more unhappy, but nevertheless feel better. In other words, we're looking for a range of distinctions that don't always operate. So if we were to take your question in relation to education, I think it seems to me better that I did a lot of work in schools and children's homes and so on. Now, it would often be the case that I would see groups of children who really had failed in terms of school curriculum. You would talk to these kids, and very soon you would discover that actually they did have passions and interests and talents and so on, but they simply didn't fit in the curriculum. Now, clearly, if you're a great dancer and you go to school and all the school is about literature and chemistry and biology and physics and history, in a way you won't have a chance. So I suppose it isn't that it's much more that I would want an educational system to be able to speak to people's genuine passions and interests. Because otherwise what you get is children who effectively have to develop a false self, a compliant self, to deal with the education, where their real love is somewhere else.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Adam Phillips. He is a psychoanalyst. He lives in London, has authored a number of books. He writes regularly for The New York Times, The Observer, The London Review of Books. He's the general editor of the new Penguin Modern Classics Freud Translations and has written a lot about Freud and his work. And is author of this new book that's titled Going Sane, Maps of Happiness is the subtitle. It's published by Forth, an imprint of HarperCollins. It's out in the bookstores now. It's a book that previously was published in Britain, where he lives, and he's now spending some time in the United States to talk about it, and we're glad to have him here with us this morning on the program. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. One idea that I want to perhaps go back a little bit to and touch on again is this idea that I think that some people would make this argument that humans, their natural state is to be a kind of a roiling mass of needs and desire, and that our natural sort of inclination would be to go out and do what we can to satisfy those desires, and that what happens as we grow up and we become civilized and socialized, we in a sense we end up giving up some things, maybe sometimes giving up those things that we really want the most. Those needs that we feel most intensely to satisfy, we say, well, we can't really satisfy them. And so some people would make this argument that, in fact, sanity somehow means giving up a lot of things, giving up those things that we really want, and that it is a kind of renunciation of passion and desire. Is that what sanity is about?
Well, I think in a cartoon version, that is what it's about. I think it's about being able to renounce one's stronger feelings in the service of being more companionable, I suppose. And I think it begs a question, and the question is whether it's only bad things that we repress, because it seems to me, for example, that very often people repress their kindness, that people are much kinder and are much more by instinct kinder than they allow themselves to be. Now, if you live in a culture in which you're told that the successful person is the person who's most ruthlessly competitive, obviously your kindness appears to make you weak. But I think a lot of people value kindness very highly, and I think one of the many reasons that religion matters is because religions give people a language for their more compassionate feelings. And they're not going to get the language of compassion from anywhere else. It's as though that's where it's protected. So I think the assumption that really we are exploitative, competitive, voracious, irrational, all these things. I think these are all pictures produced by the culture. And I don't think we have to assume or take for granted that this is literally true. And I don't think we have to assume that the best life is the one in which we sacrifice the things that matter most to us.
The book is really in two sections, and the first part is a thinking about how it is that both madness and sanity have been defined, how these things interest us, particularly how madness has interested us. And the second part of the book is looking at sanity and what sanity would mean, what a sane life would mean, looking at several different areas that can cause so much people so much trouble. Sexuality, as you said before, money, being a parent. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about those sorts of things and to talk about in terms of sex, for example, what a sane sex life would look like.
Well, one of the reasons that I had the chapters you mentioned is to find out whether the word adds anything useful to the conversation. Because sane sex, for example, would either seem to some people like a contradiction in terms, or it would mean something like sex in which people don't harm each other.
Hmm.
Now, there are people for whom sex is only exciting if there is some harm done. I'm not talking about bullying exactly. I'm talking about consenting to this. It seems to me, again, in a different way, a very pressing political question, whether there's such a thing as sane violence. You know, whether all violence is bad or whether sometimes it's required. With the sexuality question, and again, if I can just go back.
Sure.
The chapter on child rearing, on parenting, is really about what I take to be the fact that all the child rearing manuals that are available all start from the position that, first of all, the child is potentially out of hand and out of control. And they all, of course, assume that the project is to produce a sane child, a well child, a happy child, and so on and so forth. And yet anybody who's had a child knows how maddening parenting can be. The children, of course, are sweet and beautiful and adorable. They're also extremely aggressive, spiteful, demanding, and so on and so forth. Now, there's a risk. Either, it seems to me, people produce a very idealized picture of parenting, which really doesn't prepare people for this at all, because parenting is extremely difficult and painful and complicated. Or we have to be more explicit, I think, about what actually bringing a child up is like, how, in a sense, everybody loses it every so often, and how this actually might be part of sane parenting. In other words, sane parenting might involve muddling through, not always knowing what's right, getting it wrong, failing one's child every so often. And the risk of having too idealized or too standardized account is that people feel that they're failing all the time. And anybody who feels as a parent that they're failing becomes a worse parent as a consequence.
Well, it makes me, this is maybe unrelated, and yet it makes me think about the fact that going back to this business of our definitions, that we sometimes define madness as being out of control, which then would suggest that sanity is being in control.
Yeah.
And perhaps the better definition of sanity, within sanity, you have to allow for some not being in, recognizing that you're not in control and
yes,
recognizing
exactly.
That that's sort of okay.
Well, quite. I mean, and in a way, stronger than that, because I think one of the reasons that Freud is an interesting writer, not somebody one should be a disciple of, but an interesting writer, is that Freud actually says that really we don't have very much control over our lives. In fact, very often we suffer from the ways in which we over-control ourselves. Not that you simply want to release yourself into all these desires, but it may be true, actually, that one's thoughts and feelings are much less under control than one thinks. And one might be able to make an allowance, a sympathetic allowance, for the way in which one can't help but feel what one feels or desire what one desires, and this being true of other people as well. So when Freud suggests as part of his treatment that somebody goes and says whatever comes into their mind, this is like an opportunity just to see how complicated your thoughts and feelings are. That once you allow yourself to speak freely, you will surprise yourself. You will say things you didn't know that you thought or felt. And so it's something about allowing people their complexity and allowing them the fact of their inability to completely control themselves. This may not be the best picture we've got.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I wanted to ask my second question, given time for others.
Sure.
And you may have started on it just now. Does a lot of what we hope to understand about sanity depend on our theory of the mind, theory of the person? How is a mind developed or architecturally built? How is a person or a personality achieved? The simplest images I always have is the onion. We are that infant that we used to be wrapped up in the next stage and the next and so on. Or we are a committee in which various parts of our mind, already functioning and focused, have to work together. Do you have, or do you want to discuss the theory of a mind, the theory of a personality developing, and how a definition or a notion of sanity would fit into that? Just one other.
Well, I think I suppose the first thing I would say is that I think everybody has their own theory about their mind and who they are and so on. But I think one of the pictures that works for me would be something along the lines, I think, that you mentioned, which is that I think that a person in this culture is a living in an internal democracy, but is always prone to sort of fascist states of mind. That is to say, we actually have a large number of competing and conflicting needs and wishes and wants and desires, and that it's very difficult to bear the conflict that this involves. So we're always searching for a way of avoiding conflict. And the best way to avoid conflict is to narrow your mind and to be in a state of conviction. And what this tends to involve is scapegoating somebody else. So an awful lot of racism and sexism and so on is about expelling all the parts of ourselves we can't bear into the so-called enemy. So we can feel that we're good people and they're bad people. Now, in doing this, we're losing these parts of ourselves. So I suppose my picture is that it's a democracy that's very hard to hold on to, and that we have to be very, very mindful of how we're prone to, in a sense, rush towards states of conviction that will resolve our conflicts. I think it would be better to live in a culture that would actually encourage us to sustain our conflicts, to simply acknowledge that lots of things and feelings and desires are simply irresolvable. There's always going to be a conflict. A lot of people are always going to feel a conflict, for example, between needing to feel safe and secure and wanting to take risks and be excited. Now, for a lot of people, the basic sexual conflict is that they are excited by somebody or something, but in pursuing that excitement, they will threaten their safety. Hmm. Now, this is not resolvable. Because if you choose a life exclusively of safety, there won't be enough excitement in your life. And if you choose a life of excitement, you will feel terrified. So I think what we're talking about is sustaining the conflict, not trying to resolve it.
I guess that gets me back, though, to the idea that one could certainly argue that a life without conflict, fear, pain, unsatisfied desire is not going to be much of a life.
Yeah.
But it's also, I suppose, that would be an easier life if you could somehow find a way to live without experiencing those things. That, indeed, someone might say that would be the most sane life, the life without pain, but it wouldn't be much of a life.
No, I think that's right. And I think that we need to be wary of, given how frightened we are of feeling alive, how quick we are to try and deaden ourselves. Hmm. We're very good at recruiting other people and using things actually to anesthetize ourselves. And so I think you're right that if the sane life is pictured as a life in which basically one is totally anesthetized, there is no point to that life. That life won't have the edge, the drive that frustration brings, that in a sense, desire by definition is unsatisfied. One goes on wanting things, and that's what precipitates one into the future. It's the looking forward. And that involves pain. If you don't have a capacity to suffer pain, then you don't have a capacity to suffer pleasure. You need both.
So as a result of this, the exercise and doing this thinking that led to this book, now do you, obviously the book is an attempt and offering at answering the question, what is sanity? Mm-hmm. Do you now actually have a brief definition that you could offer?
I do. I wish I did. In a way, I mean, the last chapter of the book, which is called Sane Now, is mm-hmm. me giving an account of what it might be to be a sane person now. And I offered it not as a dogma, so much as a sort of provocation, in the wish that other people would, as it were, argue with it, agree with it, have their own thoughts about it. So that there is, in the final chapter of the book, my account, but it's not a prescription. It's just what an account of sanity might look like. And of course, I've written things that I believe, but I can't summarize them. They're in the sentences in the book.
And I guess perhaps we should mention that it's not exactly intended to be a self-help kind of a book, but to offer people something to think about and also obviously think about their own life.
Exactly. That is actually quite important to me, because self-help books are very useful and interesting, but they all assume that we can make choices in the most difficult areas of our lives, or that we can solve our problems through willpower. And in a way, one of the things that psychotherapy speaks up for, I think, is the limits of willpower. You know, what we can do when we can't use our willpower. And so my book is, not, as you say, not a self-help book. It's more of a sort of meditation or a provocation about the subject.
Mm-hmm. We have some other callers here. Again, someone here in Urbana to talk with on line one. Hello.
Yeah, I have a couple comments. One is I just noticed that I was on a website called Cointelligence, and I just noticed that if you substitute sanity for intelligence, that they've got a pretty good definition, which would be sanity is the capacity to respond creatively, appropriately, and successfully to varied circumstances. I kind of like that. And two, you were saying that you can't tell people what's important, but I think, in fact, the greatest works of art do exactly that, that they're an argument for what is important. And you might want to comment on that. But I had one question I did want to ask, and that is, people think that it's impossible to survive on strictly reality, that there's a need for delving into the beliefs and that have little evidence to sustain them, that kind of thing. And I was wondering if you had any general thoughts about that, about just how much, like I have a quote from Miguel de Cervantes, too much sanity may be madness, and the maddest of all, to see life as it is and not as it should be, unquote. Mm. I'll let you ruminate about that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in a way that the book is about precisely that issue. If you think of it in terms of, say, as people do, fantasy versus reality, I can have a fantasy about a good meal, but the fantasy will not itself nourish me. So if I just sit in a room thinking about food, I simply won't survive. I have to go into the world and meet reality. Now, in doing this, I have to think about what I actually want, and I probably will have to deal with other people in order to get it. And I'll have to work to earn the money to buy the food and so on and so forth. So that if fantasy doesn't engage with reality, it actually becomes a form of starvation. So that you have to have both things. So sanity wouldn't be, I mean, it would be a form of madness simply to live in one's mind. To believe, for example, that actually one's intimate relations with other people were going to be like one's sexual fantasies. Now, it's not that one's sexual fantasies are wrong, but one's sexual fantasies are they're pictures of one's desire in the absence of a real person. And so they might push you towards another person, but then when you meet up with this other person, they have to be renegotiated. So that you have to have reality to nourish your fantasy. Otherwise, you're too isolated. So it's not a question of getting the balance right so much as acknowledging that there are two distinct things here that need to be joined. It's something like that. Your comment about works of art, I think, is right, but I think that, as you said, it is an argument. In other words, when somebody makes a work of art, they are trying to persuade us, the viewer or the reader, that this is a value, that we should take this seriously, that this is important to us. Because, of course, one of the things about works of art is they have a diversity of points of view. They don't all agree. They don't produce a consensus. So that, in a way, they are showing us how what matters to us is always at odds with other things that matter to us, that there's a range of things that matter to us.
We'll see if we can get one more caller very quick. Line two, Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Mm-hmm.
Your thesis seems to be counterpoints, sanity, insanity, reality, fantasy. And earlier you were talking about some people are almost have almost like a predestination, and that you're wired genetically to behave specific ways. So in a state, what does it say about free will then?
I don't think I have said that people are genetically pre-wired to do anything. I mean, I don't know enough about this. It is clear that there is something real called genetics that is very powerfully determinative of who we are. It's also true that, as I understand it, genes are, as it were, about potential rather than reality. They don't make you do things so much as make certain things possible, and then you're dependent on the culture. So I'm assuming that who we become is a collaboration between what we our inherited genetic potential, what we bring with us into the world, and what the world offers us to use. And so it's always going to be a combination.
I think we're going to have to stop, and I wish we could continue, but we've come to the end of the time that we have. The book, if you would like to read it, is titled Going Sane, Maps of Happiness by our guest Adam Phillips. He's a psychoanalyst, lives in London. He is the general editor of the new Penguin Modern Classics Freud Translations and has authored a number of books himself, including this one, Going Sane. Mr. Phillips, thank you.
Thank you.